This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Welcome to the CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, head of content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Guy Whitby-Smith, head of solutions portfolio management, and Stuart Hitchcock, head of portfolio management, private credit from LGIM Real Assets. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the pod.
Good morning, Max.
Well, there's been a flurry of important changes in the investment landscape since last month's CIO call, in particular with regard to rates and commodity markets, set against a chorus of central bankers discussing monetary policy tightening. So with no further ado, Sonia, what market or macro development is at the forefront of your thinking, and why does this matter to investors?
That's a very good question, and the answer has to be inflation. If you look what's currently moving markets, and you've highlighted already all the discussions that are happening at the central bank level, it is because not only have we still these very high inflation prints coming through, but they're broadening. And they're broadening in areas where we have to consider them more as structural rather than transitory. And that, as we all know, will matter to markets. It will matter because it will obviously inform central banks in their decision-making process. And as we know, the starting point is so low everywhere that any change to the trajectory, and let's face it, any change to us as market participants being used to ultra-loose monetary policy and the support markets have been getting, it will be more volatile. There's no way around it. And hence, obviously, the speculation here, whether the Bank of England will potentially hike rates this year, and then obviously whether the Fed will have to bring it forward. Because what we're seeing is two things, really, and there's been a lot of attention towards the disruptions to supply chains. You know, how persistent are they? And again, I think to some extent, this had to be expected. We have shut down the global economy in its entirety last year. So assuming that reopening is a smooth operation and there will be no issues and no bottleneck probably was wrong at the start. But obviously some of these bottlenecks seem to be more persistent and as such obviously cause quite a lot of disruption and obviously price spike and dislocation. The other very interesting change is the labor market, because labor market data has come in below expectations. Again, there is high numbers of job openings, but we seem not to be able to fill those jobs. And it's very clearly distorted to some extent by all the government support that has been provided, because obviously if you're getting a check in your bank every month, why would you re-enter the job market prematurely? And there really seems to be sectors harder hit than others, but this is obviously causing a lot of debate on whether this is going to persist beyond those government stimuli being provided. And then there's finally, obviously, this idea and more debate around income inequality and potentially the implication for wage inflation and wage negotiations in the future, i.e. have we reset expectations of populations with respect to what they should expect from wage negotiations? And let's face it, those two will be far more important in our future expectations for inflation than used car prices or, you know, all the other kind of very transitory, very heavy price changes that we have seen. And it's just bringing it back to markets. It is, if you look at credit spreads, if you look at government bond yields, this is why it matters so much. There's not a lot of margin of safety anywhere in valuations. And this is why investors have to take note on the back of those data points coming in.
Right. So your key takeaway then is expect more volatility going forward.
Yeah, we absolutely. Depending on how obviously the narrative will develop. Again, we are cautious in a way because still a lot of these data points are transitory. And even if I talk about supply chain disruptions, we have to assume that eventually markets will find a way to address these. But clearly, it is still against the backdrop of economic growth being strong, more stimulus being provided. So eventually, you enter the point of closing output gaps and the market overheating. So it's a natural then reaction of central banks to step in. And it's this timing balance between those two forces that markets are trying to figure out and get their head around. But obviously, it seems that the only way is up in terms of rates, and hence, obviously, particularly the government bond space reacting to it.
Right. Well, staying with that idea of a balancing act and timing. Guy, what are markets telling us about the Bank of England and inflation outlook here in the UK? And what does the pricing look correct in your view?
Yes, thanks, Max. Yeah, I mean, pretty much as Sonia said, after a month of range-bound markets, we are really now seeing a return of volatility to rates and inflation. I'd say particularly at shorter maturities, expectation grows around the next step central banks around the world will take. And in terms of the UK and what we're seeing in terms of market pricing for the Bank of England, it's easy to forget, as little as a month ago, we had no hikes priced in for this year. But now we have a hike to 25 basis points priced in for November, as well as sort of two further hikes fully priced in by March. And all in all, that would take the base rate in the UK up to 75 basis points, which is actually the highest level that we've seen since the financial crisis all the way back in 2009. The drivers for this sort of quite dramatic shift, as sort of Sonia just said, is, well, it's basically, it's inflation, as we know all too well. It's coming in high around the globe, but also particularly in the UK. I mean, RPI in the UK is forecast to print at around 7% in April. Again, you have to go back to the early 1990s since we've seen levels of that kind of magnitude. So it's easy to see against that backdrop why we've now seen MPC members in recent weeks, in speeches they've been given, increasingly signalling that they're ready to act, ready to take action, ready to raise rates to guard against these inflationary forces becoming entrenched.
Well, that's really interesting, Guy. And you mentioned the short end, where there has been a lot of action. The longer end of the UK curve has been quite subdued. Do you think markets are potentially pricing in a policy error by the Bank of England?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that we're starting to see that, which is, you know, as the short end, we're seeing hikes priced in and continuing into next year. But actually, then we're actually seeing at the moment, actually, I thought we thought an inversion where actually some of those rate hikes are then priced out sort of 2 or 3 years forward, which does suggest that the market's sort of central expectation is that the bank will hike and then have to then subsequently lower rates, as you say, suggesting that they may get the pace and timing of it too strong.
So a tricky environment to navigate for investors. How are you navigating this landscape within LDI strategies?
Yeah, I guess the two main approaches we'd say, and we're working with clients on, I guess firstly on inflation, we'd say to go slowly with inflation hedging, and so to go slower than you naturally would. Inflation looks expensive, it looks very high. Now we understand that we've just talked a lot about what's driving short-dated inflation. But when you look at what's happening with longer dated inflation, take 30-year inflation in the UK, for example, that's risen nearly 1% since last year. That just feels like it's moved too far for us. Inflation in the short term, absolutely, we can see the sort of the short term drivers. But to suggest that this inflation is now going to be entrenched over such very long periods doesn't seem to naturally follow. And also, you've got a sort of particular dynamic within the UK pension schemes, where actually as inflation increases, the inflation sensitivity of pension scheme liabilities actually falls, which actually lessens the need for pension schemes to hedge in situations where inflation is actually rising. So we'd go lower on inflation hedging, probably perhaps sort of actually focusing more on interest rate hedging, where some of these rate rises look like, particularly as we go into sort of next year, look overdone, and that's being priced in across the curve. And actually sort of longer dated gilt yields now sort of being pushed to the sort of highest levels that we've seen in 2 years, which could present a sort of good entry opportunity for pension schemes looking to average in and increase their overall levels of interest rate hedging.
Well, thanks for talking through those dynamics, Guy. Stu, differently to Guy, you invest in private markets. So for the benefit of our listeners, these include non-listed real estate, infrastructure, corporate and alternative debt. In the context of the risks that Guy and Sonia have just discussed, what are the implications for your asset class?
Yeah, thanks, Max. It's a good question. Look, fundamentally, I don't think there's really any difference in the types of risks that we care about and that we're focused on from the public side. I think the real difference here is just the breadth of sector and kind of structure of asset classes that we're looking at. So, you know, as you rightly state, you know, we're really looking at unlisted and or what I describe as illiquid debt securities across those core asset classes. On the private side, it's probably worth a little bit of context because we've come through this, let's call it an initial COVID period, the caveat being Delta variants and the like, with no losses, no distressed assets, no defaults and no income interruptions. So, you know, touch wood, that continues. And we've not had to actively sell any assets, which has, again, been very, very pleasing from a portfolio perspective. In a way, we'd like to think that that's a function of the fact that we're a buy and hold investor. So we spend a huge amount of time analysing investment opportunities for our clients, and we're not reliant on those public ratings. So we're driven very much by the secure income nature of the assets as opposed to maybe market value accretion, because we're matching those pension liabilities. So for us, that stability is really, really important. And, you know, ensuring that we understand or can forecast a borrower's ability to repay that interest in principal and weather economic and other types of volatile conditions. But we're really not complacent because clearly those risks do affect all of the asset classes and the borrowers therein. So the kind of risks that, you know, we've been focused on over the last, let's call it year and a half, include virus variant strains, inflation, now more imminently tapering of QE and interest rate hikes, supply chains, of course, and debt ceilings and various other political instabilities. And last but not least, it's the, you know, energy price volatility. I think, you know, I think just to extend a comment or a sentiment that Guy just talked about, which was a feeling, I have to admit that I've been quite an unashamed bear over the last number of months because credit spreads don't feel quite right. They feel too tight in the context of the confluence of the risks that we have on the table at this particular point in time. I mean, if someone were to ask me, you know, what am I really focused on at this particular point in time? The two risks that I'm very much focused on are interest rate hikes and the tapering of QE, because we really haven't seen, I think, on a broad generic scale, sectoral scarring. And I'm going to paraphrase this incorrectly, I'm sure, but it's when the tide goes out that you see who's swimming naked.
Right.
And in that regard, I think, you know, we're going to see pressure on consumer spending dynamics. I think we're also going to see disruptions to goods and services. I think that those pressures will be fundamentally lower down the credit curve and on smaller to medium enterprises. Now, that's not necessarily the area that we are investing in. We're in the kind of larger investment grade and the crossover kind of asset classes. But I do see that there could be negative effects down the value chain. So we have to be really, really cautious of the contagion effects from the provision of goods and securities, you know, and services to those other issuers and some of our projects. So to my mind, I think, you know, as we move through the next number of months, I personally can see an increase in credit spreads. The difficulty, of course, is putting your finger in the air and determining what that is, because I don't think it will be A, persistent, and B, you know, hugely material in respect of the fact that we have so much money out there chasing so few assets. But I ultimately think a bit of credit correction or credit spread correction is a good thing because it allows us to have much better risk reward profiles. And that's something that it's been really absent over, I think, the last year in particular.
Right. I can see Guy nodding vigorously in the background. On one of the other risks you just mentioned, Stu, how has or will the current energy crisis affect the portfolio?
So I'll take this in a portfolio, in my portfolio terms, which is, I think we're very well positioned. As a buy and hold investor, we naturally are kind of, you know, more interested in the stable cash flows from the, let's call it, the utilities, energy related sectors. So that tends to lend itself to transmission and distribution assets, at least that part of the value chain, the energy value chain. And that's dominated, you know, by those T&D assets. They're typically regulated. They have rate mechanisms to protect against price volatility, commodity volatility. They're fee-based, and also they lack merchant price risk. That being the case, we do have to be very thoughtful about sustained periods of inflated prices, because you do have what I describe as billing risk and also time lag risk. So it needs to, we need to have an eye on that, but I think it requires a really sustained period of kind of commodity price inflation for that to affect that part of the sector. If we then turn to the energy generation side of things, our portfolio is very much characterised by renewables investment. That's a good thing in the wider context of ESG, but they're generally backed by offtake agreements from highly rated counterparties, and many benefit from subsidy mechanisms. And also they could benefit from inflated prices generally. And if we move away then, just to finish this off, if we move away from those specific direct energy sectors and think about the wider markets, we have to be thoughtful about industries that are heavily reliant on certain energy sources. For me, that would include the likes of manufacturing, generally chemicals, packaging, and then it has broader implications for kind of energy prices for consumers. Now, we're not really exposed to, if you like, the manufacturing sector in the way that maybe the wider markets are, because, you know, we're looking for those longer term cash flows. But similarly, we do have to think about knock-on effects to the consumer, and particular disposable income and the context for example, rent affordability.
Really interesting. Thank you. Sonia, returning to public markets, at the index level, global equities are still close to record highs, despite edging back quite recently. What do moves at the sector level tell us about the outlook for stocks and market leadership into year end?
Yeah, I think before going into the actual sector performance, it's important that the debate around inflation does not necessarily immediately have a negative impact on equities. So obviously the focus always has been on what's happening in fixed income markets, because they will be far more sensitive asset classes to those changes. But obviously what we have seen is that energy has been the big winner of late due to the massive dislocations and the rise in energy prices around the world. And we have seen throughout the year a continuation of the reflation trade. So I think over the 18 months period, financials actually are one of the best performers, clearly on the back of this narrative that we have discussed earlier. It is interesting that despite everything we've just outlined, as you just said, equity markets are near their record highs, even in some markets. And it's just a reflection of the strength in the economic data we're seeing, the strength in the earnings growth coming through. But hence, obviously, now we're entering the Q3 reporting period, and there's all eyes now on the strength, not only of the earnings delivered, but the outlook, because we will hear from some companies some warning noises around the dislocations we're currently seeing and the impact this might have on Q4 earnings and beyond. We would probably say we are past the peak optimism. So the revision cycle to the upside clearly is behind us. And we should not forget that the year-on-year comparison will get a lot tougher from here. It's very easy Q1, Q2, even Q3, but obviously now we're back fully into normalization mode, and now we have to factor in all the disruptions we have currently been seeing. Again, valuations obviously have adjusted with the very strong increase in earnings, so more reasonable overall, but you see a lot going on the sector level. And I think, as we've always said throughout previous podcasts, it is around the structural themes that will really identify relative winners from here. Because I think at the headline level, we do not expect any major gains, simply because of slowing economic growth, still strong, but obviously it's the rate of change that matters, and that clearly is slowing. And with everything else that's going on, because although inflation will not have an immediate negative impact, it will over time, in particular when obviously the hiking cycle really kicks in and we're entering that kind of overheating, closing of output gaps narrative.
Right. And and Stu, on the subject of optimism, we would be remiss if we didn't mention COP26, the global climate summit that begins in Glasgow later this month. I understand that private markets have been very focused on renewables and ESG more generally. Could you give us a sense of some of the net zero related activities that you've seen of late, and if there are any other actions that can be taken to drive towards these goals.
Well, this is good because I can move now from my credit spread bearishness to my ESG-related positivity. Look, I mean, the move to net zero is straightforwardly, I think, a very positive thing. And, you know, it's going to have benefits not just for the environment, but for society and I think the economy generally. I think in many ways it really is about risk management because those companies, those borrowers that are aligned and moving towards net zero are going to drive longer term value for our investments. And ultimately, you know, our aim is to avoid borrowers who don't maintain that kind of social license to operate or avoiding energy assets, which may become kind of obsolete in a decarbonizing world. So we can kind of minimize the risk to the portfolio by, if you like, not just getting on the bandwagon, but trying to support the movement to net zero. It's really interesting when we talk about the private markets, because this has really been, I think, the heartland of a lot of the ESG investment, or, you know, let's call it net zero for the moment, but ESG generally, investment over the last decade and a half. And the size of the investment that's needed, I mean, the figures that I see are almost unfathomably large, if I can pronounce that correctly. I think within the EU context, it's an estimated 360 billion per annum for, you know, through to 2030. And I think it's really important to, you know, when, as we're going to talk about the private kind of market evolution, is to acknowledge that it's not just about renewables. It's not just about the generation of, you know, via solar, wind, hydro, etc. It's also about waste minimization and disposal. It's about behaviors. It's also about capital investments. Both goods and buildings, whether that means the production of electric cars and the infrastructure to support the growth of that industry. So it's a very multi-dimensional issue. And I personally am very excited about the kind of win-win potential for us in the private markets in that regard. So we've been investing in renewables since the early 2010s. But over the past year, we've extended that investment landscape. And you know, we've done that in a number of ways because there are a number of ways of trying to solve this issue. It can be by optimization. So you can look at low or no cost interventions, such as changes in management protocols and optimized controls for companies. You can look at capital energy efficiency. So looking at measures to enhance or upgrade existing systems. You can also look at major infrastructure. So opportunities to consider kind of re-engineering the building services to substitute existing plants with new low carbon technologies. And then there's also renewables retrofit as well. So opportunities to incorporate on-site renewable electricity generating technologies. And in terms of the actions, though, that are really needed more widely to allow the wider markets to deliver this net zero change, you know, what we really do need, I think, is a wider understanding of what net zero truly is and the kind of technologies and actions that can be made to deliver net zero. And I think we also need, particularly important for investors, is a better ability to identify and compare investments. So ESG data is going to be a key focus for the next few years. The standards and consistent data provision are important to ensure the investors can verify the credentials and deliver that you're in the actual delivery of their investments, because we really need to avoid that dreaded greenwashing.
Right. So no room for complacency, but still cause for positivity. And I've completely forgotten your earlier bearishness as well.
Excellent.
Right. Guy, on a similar tack, how do our solutions team incorporate climate and broader ESG considerations into the LDI space, and what role do you see green gilt playing in LDI strategies?
So the integration of ESG considerations has always been a core pillar of our investment beliefs, and we have formalized and enhanced this over the years. I think we see four principal ways in which we see ESG to be incorporated within LDI mandates. So firstly, to embed an ESG assessment of counterparties in the review process. And importantly, this has to have real teeth to be effective. For example, we stop trading with a counterparty based solely on their poor ESG credentials. Secondly, and linked to the first, is to engage positively for change with counterparties. And we do this both as a key shareholder, but also one of their biggest client trading counterparties. Thirdly, to engage on governance. For example, helping establish best practice on any kind of industry or regulatory change. And then finally, to ensure ESG is fully incorporated within the cash funds. And the cash can make up a sizable component of LDI mandates. So it's important that that aspect is also well focused on. And then obviously you mentioned green gilt. And this is understandably one aspect that's getting a lot of attention at the moment. We saw the UK government launch a green gilt syndication programme last month. They've announced they're going to do two green gilt syndications this year. We had the first one, a 12-year bond last month. It broke a lot of records. It attracted a lot of demand from investors. It was the largest ever syndication book that we've had in the UK, over 100 billion. And it was actually the largest ever at the time. It was the largest ever green gilt sovereign issue. We're expecting a second green gilt syndication actually this week in mid-October, and it's going to be a 30-year bond this time. I guess in terms of how are clients, how do these bonds fit into LDI mandates? I mean, in principle, we sort of see two different approaches to incorporating these bonds. I guess sort of firstly, we've had a small number of our clients who've expressed explicit views of their desire to invest in green gilts. And are comfortable that that may come at a, sort of a lower cost than investing in more conventional gilts. But then for the rest and for the majority of our clients, we treat green gilts just like any other gilt. So we'll only look to invest in them if that makes sense, both from a return perspective that the yield they offer, but also from a liability matching perspective in terms of what maturity they come at and how that fits with the scheme's liability profiles. So what does that mean in practice? Well, actually the 12-year green gilt that we had last month actually didn't work for many clients from a maturity perspective. 12 years is sort of quite short actually for pension scheme liabilities. But the 30-year green gilt that we're expecting imminently and will appeal to a much wider set of LDI clients because that's sort of in the sweet spot of LDI from a maturity perspective. We're expecting it to form a much more significant component of liability mandates on the LDI side.
Well, thank you for that overview, Guy. Sonia, as always, we've covered a huge amount of ground today. What are the key takeaways for investors? And is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think there was a lot in our discussion today. And I would like to finish off really on this idea around ESG integration and obviously the excitement that is arising from the upcoming COP26 conference in Glasgow. ESG integration for us is to be the standard. And it's the standard not only because it is the right thing to do, but clearly because of this concept of financial materiality. We very strongly believe that ESG factors do carry financial materiality, and as such, they have to be included in the consideration of where to invest. We've heard a lot around the structural shifts, the amount of money that needs to be invested. And I think we tend to focus probably a bit too much on the risk mitigation, which very clearly right now is at the forefront of clients' minds. And rightly so, because the regulator obviously takes a very close look on what asset owners are doing and how ESG is considered. But I think we've heard enough today as well on the opportunity side, because shifts clearly do create opportunities. The amount of money invested will create opportunities. And looking at this against the market backdrop that we've outlined earlier hopefully shows the path on how we think clients should obviously take a very close look right now at their asset allocation to make sure that they are fully aware of the risks potentially that they're taking, because underestimating the potential impact of rising inflation and hence the interest rate cycle that might follow would be wrong. But likewise, really to think about where attractive growth opportunities might arise. And we believe that clearly climate change and ESG in and of itself will provide a lot of opportunities to look at.
Yes, opportunities as well as risks. And it's the opportunities that we find exciting. Finally, I would just like to ask everyone what you've been watching, reading, or listening to recently. I will get the ball rolling and say that I've been watching Squid Game, a dystopian South Korean TV series that's quite popular at the moment. It's compelling, but pretty dark. I also listened, I listened to an audiobook of a novel called 2034, which is about a US-China sparked Third World War, which is also pretty dark as well. Sonia, what have you been watching?
I think I've confessed a number of times that I'm not watching Netflix, and yeah. I never seem to find the time to indulge in all these marvelous series. But we haven't been to the cinema either. So I will just share that the Laut household is in between the new Bond movie and obviously Adam's Family too. So you can have a guess which one I'm going to watch first.
Two excellent films. Stu, what have you been consuming?
Well, obviously, in between all of the extreme hard work that's taking place, I have managed to finish Clarkson's Farm, which I would thoroughly recommend. I think first and foremost, because it highlights the extreme pressure that farmers are under on the basis that I think he makes £144 for an entire year's worth of work. And it did really underline to me, I guess, the importance of government subsidies. And it also started making me think about, you know, maybe the future of onshoring and the ability to kind of support such a necessary industry. But for now, I haven't worked that fully through. So I'll just say it was a lot of fun, very funny, and definitely worth watching.
Right. Interesting. Guy.
Yeah, I'm a bit less practical. I've just finished reading the Three Body Problem trilogy. I'd say for anyone that likes science fiction novels, I'd certainly recommend it. It has a very different perspective on the genre than anything that I've read before. I guess notably, it's the first book I've read which was originally written in Chinese, although I have to admit, I read the translation rather than reading through the original text.
Right, well, we've got a good list of recommendations for our listeners today. That's a great point on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Stu and Guy, for your time today. And thank you to our clients and listeners for joining us. Our next edition of the CIO call will be in November, when we'll host a special episode to dissect COP26. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via our social media channels on the LGIM blog and, of course, here on LGIM Talks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording, and do not reflect the views of Legal and General Investment Management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, lgim.com.